Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and I'm going to be talking today with Brian Kurtz. Brian, are you there?
I am. Great to hear from you, Ken, and I'm excited to talk to you about what we're going to talk about today.
This is really going to be an interesting call for anybody who's passionate about marketing, because we're going to be talking about an individual who just had an enormous influence on direct marketing, so much so that there's going to be a commemoration of his life in September. And at this event, some of the just the very, very top people of our field are going to be there. And, you know, for people that have a background in direct marketing, especially, let's say, traditional or old school direct marketing, you will instantly understand the significance of the fact that this particular group of people is gathering in memory of the subject of our call today. If you're not as familiar with traditional direct marketing, I guess you're going to have to take it on faith, but do a little research and you'll realize two things. One, this quantity and quality of experts in the direct marketing arena, I don't remember in my lifetime when it's ever been assembled. I also can't imagine how anybody's ever going to be able to put this group together again. And for those of you who will recognize the names, let me just shoot them out. Dan Kennedy, the great where the rubber meets the road expert on direct marketing. I think more people have learned the practicalities of implementing direct marketing in their business through him and through his students and any living person. Gary Bensavenga, no question, no debate, the most effective direct mail copywriter of the last 40 years, and even the top copywriters who could realistically vie for that, they all admit, yeah, Gary's the best. Greg Ranker, direct response TV, infomercials, building a business using those mediums. You've seen his infomercials every time you turn the TV on, massive enterprise. Jay Abraham, one of the great, I call him mind expanders in the marketing arena of all time. You spend an hour with Jay and your mind can never return to its original smaller shape. I'm going to be talking Perry Marshall, one of the great wizards of the practicalities of internet marketing, going to be speaking. Joe Sugarman, you probably know him from Blue Blockers, the sunglasses, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. He's done so many amazing things in the marketing arena. Fred Katona, a name you won't be familiar with unless you really know and are experienced with direct response radio, and unless you know the background story to that spectacular business success of Priceline.com, in which he had a big role. And then a ton of just, you know, top gunslinger copywriters, Eric Betule, David Deutsch, Arthur Johnson, and of course our good friend Paris Lampropoulos. Amazing lineup. Never seen it before, this level. Probably will never see it again. And it's important to understand, and that's why we're doing this call, why all these people have agreed to get together in this one place at one time to commemorate a particular guy. And we're talking about Marty Edelson. And Brian, of course, you worked with Marty for many, many years and are probably, if not the best source, certainly one of the very, very, very best sources to give us some insight into why so many people who've achieved a lot in the direct marketing and direct response arena would, you know, leave their businesses, leave their practices, leave their Hawaiian islands, and fly to Connecticut to commemorate one guy. So let's just jump right in, and I have a few questions about Boardroom. That's the business that Marty started. Now, it was originally called Bottom Line. Is that correct?
No. It was originally called Boardroom Report.
Okay.
Yeah. So Marty, and just to kind of just put a little exclamation point on your introduction, Ken. I think to answer the question of like why these people decided to come out after, and every one of them, I did not have to twist their arms. I mean, it was basically one phone call or one email, and it was almost yes at hello. And the reason why, and it's a good question, I now that you brought it up that way, it was actually Marty's direct marketing acumen certainly was part of it, but I also think that people, whoever worked with him, and I'll talk about this in a second, you know, you come in contact with certain people and you just say, I'm just going to be not only a better person for it, I'm going to be a better marketer, I'm going to be a better entrepreneur, I'm going to be a better business person. And Marty's business philosophies transcended direct marketing into, and I'm going to talk a lot about this at the event, where, you know, he just was an extraordinary entrepreneur. And his business philosophy on how people should be treated, how whether you're dealing with vendors, whether you're dealing with partners, whether you're dealing as a vendor or a partner, the I learned at Marty's knee when I was very young, and then I was able to get up and stand up with him. You know, I was with him for 33 years, and I think that's why the people are coming out. They're coming out because, you know, when you create a legacy for so many years of just incredible professionalism, incredible fairness, entrepreneurship, you know, top-notch marketing, a commitment to excellence, and everybody he ever came in contact with, most of the people who were speaking came in contact with him, and those who didn't came in contact with me, and by osmosis they were in contact with Marty, because Marty and I were joined at the hip for 33 years. So I think that's why people are coming out. They just really think that it's more than just a tribute, and it's more than just, you know, the honoring Marty. It's really to take the principles that made him great and created this kind of legacy that could create an event like this. So it's all intertwined. It's not just that we're coming up with a great event that people are coming to and we're going to have a good time. It's that the core principles of both direct marketing and entrepreneurship are going to be explored. And I think that everybody's going to walk away with much richer, much more enhanced in terms of everything that they do, both running their business and marketing. So Marty started the business in 1972. He had been the best salesman of space advertising who ever lived, basically. He worked at a variety of magazines, sold mostly mail order space, which was a big category in the magazine world back in the 50s and 60s. And in the early 70s, he worked for 10 years as the business manager at Commentary Magazine. And what Marty figured out is that he just loved business, and he loved business books. So he was a voracious reader and was both excited and frustrated at the same time, because he knew that every business book that was worth reading was probably not worth reading cover to cover. So he developed an idea for a newsletter. He wanted to do a magazine, but no one would give him the money or back him up. So he took his life savings and created a newsletter, left Commentary Magazine after 10 years, and created something called Boardroom Reports, which was basically a newsletter that was in his image of an geared toward entrepreneurs and smaller business people on how to run their business better. Marty was convinced that at the time, Business Week, Fortune, Forbes, and the Wall Street Journal didn't really tell you how to run your business. They told you what was happening at the big companies. They gave you some nice case histories that you probably couldn't apply to what you were doing. And he wanted to give practical advice to people running businesses. And that's how Boardroom Reports came to be. And most of the editorial that Marty did in the early years of Boardroom Reports was from the best business books that he read. And again, he knew that he didn't have to read those books cover to cover, and that there were a chapter or two in each of those books that were actually worth talking about. And he would interview the authors and get the guts of each. And the first promotion for Boardroom Reports was written by one of the best copywriters of all time by the name of Gene Schwartz, who we'll be talking about at the Titans event. And Gene wrote a headline that said, read 300 business magazines in 30 minutes and get the guts of each. And that was really how Marty, I always said Marty invented hypertext in 1972. And he was in Reader's Digest, and he wasn't, you know, there were companies later on, you know, Soundview Summaries and Philosopher's Notes. And I think a lot of people owe Marty a debt of gratitude in the quote-unquote digest field and getting the greatest hits from the greatest people. That's how Marty operated. So that's how the company started, and then he started doing a lot of business books, tax books, things that kind of related again to the same audience. And then in 1980, he came up with the idea that he said, look, let's do a newsletter for the personal side of that same executive. And that's when he came up with Bottom Line Personal. And that's about when I got to the company. I got to the company in 1981. Bottom Line Personal had already been launched. But together, you know, we started really building on that franchise. And in pretty short order, Bottom Line Personal eclipsed Boardroom Reports in terms of circulation size, in terms of reach. And actually, in terms of direct marketing, Marty and I both realized that the lists that were going to be available in the consumer market for we'll call it the personal side of the executive, you could start using more consumer lists, and you wouldn't have to worry about finding business lists or home office type lists, which were much harder to find in direct mail at the time. And so we kind of, it's the old Wayne Gretzky thing. You know, you go where the puck is going, not where the puck is. And Marty saw that the consumer market was where we were going to be able to build a much bigger business. And then from there, again, seeing where the puck was going within the consumer market, the health field was just going crazy at the time in the mid-80s, into the late 80s, into the early 90s. And so a lot of the focus in Bottom Line Personal then became health. And then we started. Then we launched a health newsletter, actually two different health newsletters. And then we started doing health books. And all of a sudden we went from, you know, business publisher Boredom Reports to consumer publisher Bottom Line Personal to consumer books. We did a bunch of consumer books that were kind of Bottom Line's greatest hits. We had one called The Book of Inside Information that sold 3 million copies in direct mail in the 80s and 90s, and then went to health as a subgroup of the consumer market and started launching these huge health books. And the health franchise became our biggest. So, you know, fast forward to today, if you look at our 9 million name database, I would say, you know, 80% of our customers are probably have bought some product that was actually related to the health field. And yet where we started in 72 was in the business field, and there's nobody on our database that really you would equate to that to that audience anymore. So it's a really interesting study. I just did, you know, 45 years in like, you know, 5 minutes. But it really is a study in not just demographic shifts, but also in how as a marketer and how as a company you kind of move with where the audience might be going based on what you can deliver, as opposed to being stubborn and staying in one aspect of editorial and say, okay, I'd rather be in the business arena because that's where I started, that's where my love is. I mean, Marty always had a love for business till the day he died. But I think, you know, realizing that Boardroom Reports was not going to be a franchise that he could grow, Bottom Line Personal was, and then he could have much bigger reach and much bigger influence on many more people. And he still was able to cover a lot of business topics based going through, you know, with Bottom Line Personal, and we had a tax newsletter, and in the health field, you know, keeping executives healthy, make sure that they can run their businesses better. So it all stayed linked up, but I think it was all about Marty wanting to make a bigger impact, and making a bigger impact is everything. So that was kind of 45 years in 5 minutes. But
Well done. And it is an absolutely fascinating story. And anybody interested in the longevity of their business would do well to study that. Now, a lot of people are judge things by numbers, and we really haven't talked about numbers. You mentioned your 9 million person database, and that's subscribers, buyers. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that would be like everybody going back that is, I'll call it a promotable universe, although we don't mail 9 million names. We probably have 2 million customers at any one time that I would consider more active, last 24 month or 36 month. But because of the way we do direct marketing, you know, you don't give up on names from 24 months ago or 6 or 36 months ago who bought from you, which is, again, one of the great lessons that we'll be teaching at the Titans event, that a lot of online marketers are, and I'm not saying this in a critical way at all. I mean, there's so much I learn every day from the best online marketers, and we're an online marketer too. But I think that the concept of lifetime value, of being able to look at your customer base, being able to reactivate people who bought from you a long time ago to buy something new from you is critical if you want a business for the long haul, instead of just a series of revenue events or a series of new customers every year. I mean, there's a rule of thumb in direct marketing that says it's a lot cheaper to keep an existing customer than to get a new one. And so the whole business, the whole subscription model, the whole direct marketing rule of thumb of basically, you know, cultivating your database, making sure that you develop relationships and not just transactions, is just so critical to everything that we did for so long. As far as numbers, you know, it's funny. People when they have me send a bio for whatever I'm speaking or whatever I'm doing, you know, I always preface it and say, look, I'm not bragging, you know, and I think Dizzy Dean had the quote, the baseball player. I thought it was John Wayne, but he said it too. You know, it ain't bragging if you did it. But so this is not a bragging conversation at all, but it is just to give you some context. We as a company have probably mailed somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.3 billion pieces of direct mail over the last 20 years. So I guess before we were keeping track, if I go back the full 40 years, it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, close to 2 billion pieces of direct mail. And I only say that number not for effect, but remember, when you're doing direct mail, you're paying a lot more to put those messages in the mail. So the thought and care that you have to put in before you send out that much direct mail at the cost that we did is a lot different than sending out 2 billion email promotion, which costs you a lot less. But I maintain that the same thought process should go into your email promotions as it did for us in direct mail. I did a blog post with CopyBlogger, which is a great site for copywriters, and the title of it was How Paying Postage Made Me a Better Marketer. And I think that when you think things through the way we did as direct mail, as a direct mail company, it's made us better, a better marketer online. So that's one number I always throw out, the 1.3 billion or 1.3 to 2 billion direct mail pieces. As far as subscribers, Bottom Line Personal at one point had 1 million subscribers paid to a paid newsletter of at $30 or $40 a year. Right now it's around 400,000, which for a print newsletter is still not too shabby.
How many thousand?
400,000 paid subscribers to a print newsletter still. Now, I understand that that's not going to go up a lot, as people, print isn't dead, but it certainly is not the preferred medium for the new generation coming up. But we have iPad versions and we have all the digital versions of what we do. But I think in this day and age, they still have 400,000. And then we have another 100,000 to our health newsletter. So to have 500,000 paid subscribers to print newsletters in 2014 is a tribute to either our stubbornness or our the way that we market, the way that we create a database, the way that we look at renewals as opposed to just getting new subscribers. Our renewal rates are very high still for what I consider to be a fairly broad-based consumer newsletter. Other numbers that are interesting, in the online side, we still send out somewhere close to 20 million emails a month, most of which are editorial in nature in that we send out e-newsletters because we really feel like we want to use, I think, the medium, being used for delivering content, it first and foremost, is still great. Content marketing is kind of the buzzword that you hear. But, of course, you have to give those away for free, those e-newsletters, and therefore they get supported by advertising, both for our own products and for third-party products. In direct mail and in our newsletters in print, we never had to move to an advertising model, which I'm also pretty proud of, but being free of advertising online is just a lot more difficult when you need to pay the bills. You can't just email's cheap, but it's not free. So
especially the numbers you guys mail.
Yeah, and they're big numbers, and we do want to deliver value, but we also want to make sure we finance the mission, as it were. And some other numbers that are interesting is that, and again, we're going to talk a lot about this at the Titans event. I've been talking on a bunch of different podcasts and stuff about the fact that I bought a URL recently, and it's www.singlechannelmarketingissoboring.com. And I really own that. If you go to it, you end up going to my website. But I bought it for effect, but I bought it for a reason, because I think one of the things that I think every marketer, and I hope that every marketer thinks in terms of direct marketing, or at least, measurable advertising, which is what direct marketing is, and that to be in one medium is a crime. And it's also dangerous. You hear the horror stories of online marketers getting shut down by Google, and then they're out of business. And so I think a mix of using all different types of media, especially when Greg Ranker takes the stage at Titan, you think of Duffy Ranker as this, they are a $1.8 billion business who's known to be the number one company to do that does infomercials on TV. And yet when we do this session at Titans, and I've already talked to Greg about this, we're going to be talking to one of the great multi-channel marketers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy Proactive, which is their number one. I don't even know if they're number one anymore. I think the Cindy Crawford product might be their number one. But Proactive was their number one product for so many years. And I guess people know you can buy Proactive in a kiosk in a mall. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to put Proactive on the shelves at CVS. And we're going to talk about why they did it that way, like which places they did want to advertise and which places they didn't, and which places they wanted to sold and which places they didn't. And that's how you build a multidimensional brand in different media. And so to me, that is like one of the most important concepts. So when I talk about boardroom numbers, which was your original question, we did probably between $200 million and $300 million alone when we got into infomercials. And that was taking some of our books to TV and then bringing them back to direct mail, and then also doing online advertising with the same products that were on TV. And so this, I called it the trifecta of direct response media, to have products that were cooking all at the same time on TV, infomercials, indirect mail, same products, and on banner advertising online. was probably one of the great success stories of all time, and the numbers were huge. I mean, we were buying, you know, $80 million a year in, we probably spent $100 million in just on TV advertising over that period, over those 2 or 3 years, and all profitable, all paid out, and all tracked through different media and lifetime value of all new customers coming in, and all boats rose because of the... So singlechannelmarketingissoboring.com is one way. I guess the next website I need to buy is singlechannelmarketingissoimportant.com or singlechannelmarketingissocritical.com. So, you know, those are some numbers. I don't know if those are some of the numbers you might be looking for, but, and again, I'm not doing them to brag. I'm doing them to give people a sense of scale of what you can do when you open up your mind to being a multi-channel marketer.
Well, it speaks to credibility. You know, we can say what a great businessman and entrepreneur Marty was, but then when you see the actual numbers and you see the longevity, which is, I think, a very key feature. This was not a flash in the pan. This is not somebody that happened to hit the right thing at the right time and had a great year or two. This is a guy who did this for decades. And, you know, we could talk about the marketing angle and the copywriting angle. You know, for instance, you pointed out that the very first copywriter who wrote copy for Boardroom was Eugene Schwartz, who's, you know, maybe, you know, if you had to list the top five copywriters of all time, I think you'd have to put Gene on that list.
Mm-hmm.
And Marty, over the years, employed many of the greatest of the great copywriters. But that, by the way, inspired so much of us. Those of you listening to this who are started your marketing careers after the internet, you can't believe the paucity. You can't imagine the scarcity of information on how to do direct marketing. There just wasn't much, especially from a practical point of view. A lot of broad stroke stuff and big picture stuff, but nitty-gritty stuff. So one of the ways that we learned was we would take the mailing pieces of Boardroom and study them. And
yeah.
Say, okay, we know these are working because they're mailing them all the time. Wow, what an amazing headline.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a great, you know, response device. Wow, you know, and so that was literally, that was our school, and it was our only school, because they were just, I mean, how many books were there on direct marketing in 1980?
There were a few. You know, you had Bob Stone and you had Ed Nash and you had these basic books on direct marketing, and I got them all at the time. But there was still Breakthrough Advertising by Gene Schwartz, which was written in 1966, which on the one hand is not a direct marketing book, but maybe the most important book ever written. I don't even want to say on copywriting and creative. I want to say on human behavior, which is really what copywriting is about, when you think about it.
You broke up for 1 second. Copywriting is all about?
It's all about human behavior.
Human behavior.
All about,
absolutely.
Yeah, and so the book Breakthrough Advertising was really written by Gene Schwartz. We reprinted that book. It was written in 1966, and we haven't changed one word of it when we reprinted it. It's still completely applicable today, and we'll be talking about Gene at the Titans event. We'll be giving away, actually, a very rare presentation that Gene did on DVD. I have it on DVD. I had it on VHS. I had to put it onto DVD. That's how old it is. And we'll be giving away, going back to what you said about studying the great pieces. I mean, back then, there was a service called Who's Mailing What, which is still around, by the way. Denny Hatch, who's one of my mentors, basically set up a database of every direct mail piece that he could find, and people could get copies of them, you know, by being a subscriber to the service. And the value of what we call a swipe file, of being able to see all those, is still available. It's all online now. Who's Mailing What has an online service, and they have email too, email promotion as well.
Oh,
so
wow.
Studying all of that stuff is so, so critical. And in that spirit, what we're going to give away at the Titans event, one of the things, we're giving away a lot of stuff, but one of the things we're giving away are these two binders. And in each binder, one binder will be basically Boardroom's greatest hits of every control package, 15 of the best control packages that we ever did with the best writers ever. So there's a couple of Gene Schwartz packages in there. There's a package by an unknown writer who was one of our best named Mel Martin. There's stuff in there by Gary Bensavenga, Jim Rutz, one of the great writers of all time, Clayton Makepeace, just some great writers. And then the second binder is what I call Boardroom's Mount Rushmore of copywriters' greatest hits. And so at Titans, we have this panel with the four writers you mentioned, Eric Betchel, David Deutsch, Arthur Johnson, and Paris Lampropoulos, and we took their packages, which were the best packages that they've written since 1995, which we've mailed in excess of 600 million pieces just with those alone. And we have PDFs and CDs of all of those packages. So these two binders alone are going to have 30 of the best packages that we've ever mailed since 1972. And you'd say, oh, a lot of that is just, you know, old yellow paper. Well, au contraire, you know, even in PDF, well, in PDF they won't be yellowed, so that's good. And and on CD they won't be either. And what's in those packages is a lifetime of learning for any great copywriter. It's a course. It's really a course. Now you don't have, and we'll have some, you know, things, you know, just some support materials. I'm not going to teach people how to be a copywriter because I'm not one. But there's so much you can learn by studying those packages. So I'm a huge believer in swipe files and reading all you can. And we're also going to be giving away a lot of great books at the event in the spirit of exactly what you said. There is a lot more written today about direct marketing and direct response that people can sink their teeth into. And I'm for educating.
Yeah, that's quite a swipe file you're going to be offering. That's what we did. We would wait for the boardroom pieces to come out and just you know, drool over them, basically, and go, oh my God, where did they come up with that headline? You know, one of the great headlines: what food or foods never to eat on an airplane?
Yeah, what never to eat on an airplane was a classic. That package is in the swipe file. That was for Bottom Line Personal.
You know, I mean, it's just, and that I don't know if Mel Martin came up with the name of that, but
he did.
You guys called it Fascinations. You called that?
Yeah, that's a great memory. I mean, yeah, there was an. In fact, I'm gonna blog about that soon because Mel Martin is a writer no one ever heard of, and he kind of fashioned himself. He studied a writer back in the '60s by the name of Ralph Ginzburg, who was a pioneer in writing space advertising for the most part, and. But Mel came up with his own style. And, yes, I think fascinations, I don't know, I wouldn't say we invented them. You know, we call them bullets. Some people call them whatever. Gene Schwartz was a master of them as well. And it's the idea that, you know, would never eat on an airplane, see page 46, which is like usually would refer to the premium, you know, that we're giving away in the package. I remember some of Mel's classic ones. He had how to outwit a mugger in a self-service elevator, how to know when a slot machine is ready to pay off. It was just like one after another, and every one of them would have a page number, which then adds to the excitement, and that's why we called them Fascination. The interesting thing, and we'll talk about this at the Titans event with the copywriters, is the evolution of content marketing as we've moved online. And back then, it was almost all what we call all sizzle, no steak. You know, you really had to give the fascination, but you would never give the answer because they had to buy the product or at least get a trial subscription to the product in order to see the answer to all of those fascinations. Mm-hmm. What happened over time, as we developed longer forms in direct mail, like Magalogs and Bookalogs, which are long-form direct mail, 24 pages, 32 pages, self-mailers, we started actually giving away some steak. You started giving away, so for example, you would say the seven things to know when a slot machine is ready to, I'm making this up, the seven things to know that when a slot machine is ready to pay off, and you list three of them right there in the promotion, and then you say to the other four, page 67. And so that was an evolution, and of course now we've gone full circle into the online world where in a lot of times you'll see some of the best marketers give away their best stuff in the promotion, even though, you know, it kind of violates that old rule of steak and sizzle. So, you know, just give away the sizzle, not the steak. And I think that's a really nice evolution of promotion. And the great copywriters came along for the ride on that. You know, I'm sure when I'll use Gary Bensavenga as an example, but when he speaks, he'll probably speak to this when he speaks at Titans. But I think that I'll use someone like, you know, David Deutsch or Paris Lampropoulos or Arthur Johnson. When they were writing number 10 packages back in the 80s or 90s, you know, they were probably giving away very little. And now when they do their Magalogs and Bookalogs, they give away quite a bit. So, you know, and they learned how to do that better than anybody because they were already so skilled in the other form. So the fascination format is just a phenomenal thing in itself to track, and it'll be great to talk about all this. I mean, you know, I'm going to be going down a little bit of memory lane at Titans, but you know, I don't want the sessions to be just about old war stories. This is about how we take what we've learned, the eternal truths, and how we apply them to today's marketing.
Well, I think, you know, the ability to write fascinations which I think is a better name than bullet points, because I see a lot of people writing bullet points, and they are literal. They think, okay, I'll put 8 bullet points here, and then I'll just fill them in with something.
Right.
And that's so the wrong approach. And
exactly.
It is, yeah, and so calling them a fascination and understanding their function, why would you even go to the effort of coming up with something like that, is really important. And then, of course, studying the great people that did. I gave a course. I have a course in copywriting, and I think we spent half a day on fascination. I think they're the bridge. If you think of writing a sales letter or anything that you do promotionally as the wall, I think of the ability to generate fascinations as the brick. If you can, and of course, Gene would write, hundreds of fascinations, and then those that made the cut would actually make it into the letter. And he used to say, I don't write copy, I assemble it.
Mm.
And I think the model of being able to generate all these fascinations, and again, it's a perfect word, and then take the best ones and use them in your headline, and use them in your subhead, and use them in your calls to action, and you use them as bullet points is a really good model for copywriting. And I don't know a better school for this than the boardroom school. So it's very exciting that all these folks are going to be together who are actually doing this, not only have a long track record of it, but are doing it right now and generating numbers right now. But
yeah, I would add, Paris Lampropoulos in particular, and I told him I'm going to put him on the spot at the event. He has a whole group of what he calls copy cubs that are kind of they kind of learn at Paris's feet. And, he's developing a whole new generation of copywriters. He doesn't care whether it's offline or online, but what is he mm-hmm. teaching them first? How to write the best fascinations. And, going to the Paris Lampropoulos School of Writing Fascinations is really painful. I mean, he in a good way, he is just a brutal teacher. And he's like the tough football coach that, faster, faster, better, better. And, as you said, I think you made a great point just now about the bricks and about how Gene used to say that he assembles copy and that he had so many to choose from, and he threw out the ones that didn't make the cut. And then I'll add Marty into this. Marty used to always challenge the copywriters to say, if you're going to write me fascinations, make sure they make me vibrate. And, Marty was not a copywriter, but what a great eye he had, and what a great feel he had for
mm-hmm.
what was going to make the customer vibrate. And that's
mm-hmm.
a skill in itself. So I would encourage people to think, and we'll talk a lot about this, the client-copywriter relationship and what the expectation might be from a copywriter to a client and then from a client to a copywriter, because I think there's a lot of amateurs right now in both sides. When I say amateurs, I'm not saying that to be disparaging. What I'm saying is that you have copywriters who aren't getting enough information from their clients to do the best work that they can do. And by amateurs on the client side, they're not supplying their copywriters with the right information so that they can do the best that they can do. So we're going to talk about specifics on both sides of that equation, which I think will be game-changing for a lot of people who are either on the marketing side or the copywriting side.
Well, yeah, it's you're dealing with people that dealt and continue to deal at the very highest level of all these arts, and
yes,
it's just as boardroom functioned in the 80s as an informal school for copywriters. So all of us waiting for the next boardroom mailing so we could take it apart. You guys are continuing to do that, and let's put it this way: there's a lot of room for improvement, which should be exciting to everybody. There's anyone writing copy now can absolutely write way better copy with just a few adjustments in direction. And you're going to get, and you get that from being exposed to the very best people. And we're lucky that some of them are willing to teach and explain what they're doing. But beyond marketing stuff, which we could talk about for at least 10 days and not scratch the surface, Marty was also just very wise about so many different things. And I want to talk about two very seemingly simple things he did that everybody could be doing and nobody's doing, or 0.0001% of us are doing. And he set such a good example, and it was so brilliant. I know it had a big impact on his success. Number one was he made sure that at least once a month he got together with a ever-shifting variety of the brightest people he knew. Can you talk a little bit about the dinners, the great dinners that he had?
Sure.
I'm happy, lucky to get to go to two of them.
Yeah, so the boardroom dinners are a classic. In fact, there's a book written by Rick Frischman, a good friend of mine, who wrote a book called Networking Magic. And chapter two, it's just called The Boardroom Dinners. And basically it outlines how Marty did it. I mean, why it's not just it's not just getting a bunch of people together and having dinner. It's really surrounding yourself with the smartest people. One of the things that I'll say, and actually as in the Titans event, one of the bonuses in the VIP package was that I'm having a dinner. Unfortunately, it's sold out, but the dinner will be basically, I'm going to kind of imitate what we do to do. I'm not only going to have a boardroom dinner with people who are coming to the event and with Dan Kennedy and I hosting it, but I'm also going to teach people how to do it because it's not that hard. But you really need there are a lot of little finesse techniques, and I have it all in this chapter in this book, and we've made pamphlets about it, so I probably can make that available. I probably will make that available actually in the I'll make it part of the giveaways, which I did not talk about in the promotion. But anyway, the idea is, you know, we had all these people who wrote for us who were from all different fields, whether they were from medicine or finance or marketing or anything. And the concept for me, and this is my concept, but I think Marty always agreed with it, is that I'll tell a little tangent for a second, and I'll come right back.
Okay.
I had a mentor by the name of Dick Benson, who was probably the number one guy in the world on direct mail. And I used to go visit him once every few months to show him all our promotions. And he wrote one of the best books ever on direct mail called Secrets of Successful Direct Mail. And I'd sit at his feet for a whole day, and, you know, he would just rattle off, you know, we tested that in 1957. Don't do that, Brian. We would want to do that. You might want to try this. You might want to do this offer, this price, blah, 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 blah. At the end of the day, one day I said to Dick, I said, how'd you get so smart? And he looked at me and he put his thumb and his index finger about an inch apart. And he said, I know everything about this much. So now let me go back now to the boardroom dinners. When you get a bunch of people around a table who are experts in some part of some field, and you ask them to tell you everything about this much, you are guaranteed to have a life-changing experience by having them all at the same table for a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
So the way the boardroom dinners are structured is that we don't let them introduce themselves. I get everybody's biography in advance. At the beginning of the dinner, I introduce everybody. I walk around the table. We also set the table up because I've seen the bios in advance, and I try to put people next to each other. It's assigned seating, of course. If people come with a spouse, they don't sit next to a spouse. If people come with a business partner, they don't sit next to their business partner. What good is that? And you set the table up in a strategic way so that everybody's learning from each other based on maybe some synergies that they might have based on what I've read in the bios or what Marty read in the bios, and we set the table up. So we basically orchestrate the table in a way that will be conducive to maximum learning and maximum connection. So then at the beginning of the dinner, I read the bios, I walk around, I give everybody's bio quickly, and then we eat dinner, people talk with each other and their neighbors, and then the key is that we don't just let the dinner go by itself. We sometime either at the end of the main course or maybe even during the main course, depending on how many people we have because we want to get around the whole table, is that we pass the microphone around. We have a microphone. And every person is expected to do a share, basically, 5-10 minutes maybe, depending on how many people we have. And they can share something about their business. They can share something about a passion in their personal life. And when you've got people who are just making a difference in so many different fields and so many different ways, giving someone a microphone for 5 minutes to kind of talk about, going back to Dick Benson's thing, about they know everything about this much and they're going to give you 5 minutes, they're going to pick a greatest hit. You know, they're going to pick something that's going to be something that you can use, something that you can share, something that Marty sometimes would say, you know, would make a good article for one of our publications. Whatever it is, now you've got everybody participating. And then there's a bunch of other little things that the boardroom dinners, so that makes it particularly special, all the things I just said. And then the way you follow up, you know, so right now, you know, while we don't have a Facebook group after each dinner, but in the 1980s there was no Facebook. So what we did was we, you know, made sure everybody was connected to everybody so that everybody got a follow-up package after the dinner with everybody's contact information and a three-dimensional package full of stuff, whether it was some of our books, some of the books written by some of the guests who donated them for the package. So there became this connection from the dinner itself from the expertise that was shared that night. And one thing I do at every boardroom dinner, even today, is at the end of the dinner, I just say that was the best boardroom dinner ever. Because each one is the best boardroom dinner ever, because you never know what the mix of people are going to be. You never know what the interactions are going to be. You never know what the follow-up package is going to be. And you never know who you're going to sit next to. And everything about it becomes this event that people think that if they're just going to a dinner at the Four Seasons restaurant in New York, which is cool in itself, they're mistaken. They're going for an experience. And so it's pretty simple. I mean, as I just said all that, it's like there was nothing in what I just said that was magic. There was nothing in what I said that was secret. But you can put it, you don't have to do the Four Seasons restaurant in New York. You can do, you know, a local pub with a private room. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, the atmosphere does, you know, you need privacy. You need some intimacy of sorts. And it works best probably with around 15 people. I've done them with as many as 30. And the one at Titans is actually going to be done with about 60 people around the table. And so I'm going to do an abbreviated bio, of course, on each person. But I'm going to get people to understand what the whole system of doing it is, even though I'll be able to show them with 60 people in the room how to do it with 15. It's phenomenal. And you know, the bottom line, Ken, was that Marty just wanted to always surround himself with the smartest people. He said there's no better way to spend an evening than sharing with other people who were smarter than him in areas that he didn't know much about. And even if he did know something about it, he learned something in that area. So incredible, incredible education and incredible Marty always bettering himself.
Mm-hmm. And you know, so you say it's a simple thing, and it is. The difference is, though, he did it. He did it every month, month in, month out, year after year after year. And you know, he became a great talent scout. As you mentioned, he also got a world class education for himself every month. He also connected people. I sat next to Michael Fishman, who's been a great friend ever since at one of those.
And he's actually speaking at Titans. The one group you didn't mention, because it's the last roundtable, is my own personal mastermind group that I sit with. I call it my $25 group, as opposed to $25,000 group, because we just buy bagels for $25. And so the four of us, it's me, Michael Fishman, Jim Quick, and Ryan Lee, and the four of us, that's about, that kind of a group is about accountability, and that's a different type of, not boardroom dinner, but that's like getting together monthly. And Michael is a hero. I mean, he's a titan of direct response, but he's also just a titan of humanity.
And so, you know, one of the things from the dinner is that, you know, a simple idea but executed relentlessly and with intelligence, and also the fact that Marty was constantly educating himself. That was a never-ending quest for him, and I think that's just a fundamental. If you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're going to be a successful entrepreneur, you're going to have staying power, you're going to maximize your opportunities and your income, learning is just essential. You know,
then taking it into your organization, I mean, Marty studied Kaizen, he studied continuous improvement with Deming, and then he developed what he called iPower, which is, you know, his own continuous improvement system based on the concept of Kaizen. And basically, as you just said, he was a lifelong learner. He made his organization a learning organization. Like, we used to get guest speakers in the organization all the time. Like, people would come in and speak to us, and, you know, we're going to have an afternoon with Dick Benson. We're going to have an afternoon with Gene Schwartz. We're going to have an afternoon with, you know, a nutritionist. We're going to whatever. I had Sean Stevenson come in, who's a great speaker. We're constantly learning as an organization, because why, you know, Marty used to always say, you know, good, better, best, never let it rest till the good is better and the better best. That was on his stationery. And if you're not going to continually, you know, kind of strive for something bigger and better and be the world's best, you know, he used to always say to me, you know, you only go through life once, you might as well be the world's best. You don't get to be the world's best by just hanging out alone and, you know, at home. You got to always be in that learning mode. So it was the personal learning, yes. And then if you're an entrepreneur who's lucky enough to build an organization of, you know, of whatever amount of employees, to take that learning concept and create a learning organization is just how Marty lived his life.
Well, he was a great talent scout for finding the best and the brightest. And then once he found them, working with them in the most pleasant and productive and efficient and growth-promoting
ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're coming up on our hour, so maybe we need to start wrapping it up. But he also had a philosophy about how to treat people in general. I mean, just beyond entrepreneurism, beyond building effective organizations, beyond being the best marketer. You and boardroom have a philosophy, a real, you know, not just something spouted, but something actually lived about how to treat your fellow human being. Can you talk a little bit about that? That might be a good place to end.
Yeah.
Because it's important. It's something that gets overlooked. You know, it's not all marketing technology here. There's something really important.
Yeah. I'll do two things I'll say to that. One, we'll talk about it in terms of generosity, just incredible generosity, and the other in terms of fairness. So on the generosity scope, I can tell you that in my 33 years, I can count on maybe two hands. It's close to one hand, but maybe it's two. It's somewhere between 5 and 10 probably, of a check that I was not able to pick up at a restaurant. And that's not to say that, you know, I want to make sure that I pay for my food. It's just a philosophy, and I'm only using that as more figuratively than it is literal. But it's a figurative thing because we were like that in everything that we did in our business. That basically, you know, I'm talking about buying lunch for printers and envelope salesmen who had a quota of how many lunches they had to buy for their clients. So this idea that you always wanted to be generous, you always wanted to, let me take it a step further, that you always wanted to connect with people on an ongoing basis. You know, Marty and I used to talk about, you know, I won't say the frivolousness of sending Christmas cards during Christmas. That's fine. I'm not a bah humbug guy. But what about sending stuff all year round as stuff comes up that might be of interest to people? So this idea of sending nice notes to people, of giving gifts when they weren't expecting them for something, a job well done, you know, Marty sending balloons and candy and whatever to copywriters when they got a control. I mean, the examples are endless. But it's all about being generous. It's all about always being in the giving mode and not expecting anything in return. So go ahead.
You just, you know, it's a simple thing, but, you know, it had a big impact on me. You know, whenever you get a letter from Marty, it was clearly from Marty's desk.
Yeah.
Never a form letter. And he always signed it with this big green.
Yeah, big marker, right?
Magic marker. And you felt like the guy, you know, and he was communicating with you. And this is something that, wow, this gets overlooked. I see this mistake being made. You build a so-called big enterprise, and you know, next thing you know, you're not relating.
Well, you lose the personality. I mean, you don't. Every check he sends out to like a copywriter or a vendor, he always would sign the check, like not just the check at the bottom. He would write a note on the, you know, on the stub. You know, great job, Marty, or, you know, whatever. And we still do that to this day. You know, his kids, when they sign the checks, you know, that go out, or I ever signed a check that went out, I always put a personal note on it.
We're doing business with human beings.
Exactly.
These are our fellow human beings. And he lived that. And when you say hanging around with Marty makes you feel like, you know, hanging around with Marty made you feel like you wanted to be a better person, we're not just talking about, you know, making more money or being a shrewder businessman or being a better marketer. It was you just wanted to up your game and how you dealt with your fellow human being.
No question.
Based on his example. Yeah.
So that was the generosity side. The fairness side was another one. And I may cry when I say this, but, you know, 2 or 3 days before he passed away, I was at his house. He was kind of in and out. He was definitely, you know, we knew he was in hospice was in. But he wasn't 100% conscious, but conscious enough to know I was there. You know, he knew I was sitting on his bed talking to him. And, you know, he acknowledged a few things by shaking his head and stuff like that. And so I was just talking to him just to fill his head up with more stuff, you know, because he loved to listen to what I was doing on the business. So I was actually talking about a specific negotiation that I was in the middle of. And, you know, he and I negotiated, you know, thousands of contracts together. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you know, this is like basically on his deathbed, he opened his eyes and he said, got to be fair. And it's got to be fair. And so I only say that for a little bit of a dramatic effect because it was my whole 33 years with him that was about that. But to use an example, for example, like whenever we did a contract with someone, copywriter, database vendor, any kind of partnership, where we ended up getting a much better end of the deal after the first test or whatever, Marty was notorious, as I have been, to revise it without them asking to revise it. In other words, this idea that just because I made out better than you doesn't mean that that wasn't just a windfall on a bad deal. And so there were many times when we sent unsolicited checks to people for a deal that we thought we got the better end of. Now, I will say the other side, because most people don't think like that, on deals where I think we got the shaft, did other people have that same philosophy? Generally not, but that didn't make us not do it. And in direct marketing, which is one of the beauties of direct marketing and direct response, is that I love doing contracts that are more open-ended. It sounds like I'm not into I don't really like lawyers running my business, and I do have contracts and I do have legal agreements. However, we have a lot of agreements that say, here's what we're going to do for the test. This is what the deal will be for the test, and we'll pay it. We'll both honor this deal. But then after the test, let's look at the results. Let's be transparent. Let's show what the profit pie looks like, because we don't know what the results are. That's the beauty of direct marketing. Everything's measurable. And then once we have the result, let's then, on the rollout, revise this based on what the expectation is of what the percentage of the profit should be at both ends of this agreement, and actually get an agreement that's actually closer to what we'll call fairer than the one that we were estimating before we had results. And it's kind of, again, it sounds a little naive because it says, oh, you better get a contract, you'll get screwed, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's backfired on occasion. But more times than not, it's a much better way to do business, if you can do it. Now, there are certain times you're making an agreement with some huge conglomerate, and you have to have a legal agreement, and you're not going to do agreements with a handshake on the test, or at least a test quantity deal versus a rollout quantity deal. But I will tell you that I've made a ton of deals that are exactly that, and boy, has that made my life more fulfilling. And Marty taught me that. We always believed in that. And whenever you can do it, it's a really great way to do business, because all of a sudden partners are really partners. You're walking the walk of partnership instead of just talking the talk of partnership.
So, if we were to sum this up, Marty was a real example of an effective entrepreneur and business owner and marketer. And when you're a business owner, you're also a business operator. But he also exemplified a lot of the finer qualities, the finer potentialities of being a human being, and brought those things into his business relentlessly in how he dealt with his staff, how he dealt with vendors, how he dealt with colleagues. And it wasn't just lip service. It was something that was lived year in, year out for decades. And bring this full circle, why are all these great marketers, as you mentioned, I know I was one. I when you said we want to do this thing and it's going to commemorate Marty, I was like, okay. I didn't need an explanation.
It was amazing. I had you at hello. All the speakers were like that after. I mean, you were one of the first ones I went to, because I knew he thought incredible. Well, I think very highly of you too, but he thought very highly of you. I was honored to speak at your last system seminar. You were close with a lot of the people that were, we have mutual mentors, as it were. You were somebody that I really wanted to be part of this event, and I know that Marty's smiling down on both of us right now.
Well, I was trying to calculate. I did know Marty and the boardroom for over 20 years, and I did register your domain name, boardroom.com, and I was one of the people that was brought in the 90s to explain the internet to an understandably bewildered staff, and so it goes back a long time. So every industry has its highest aspirations. We all want to do our best, not only our best work, but we want to function and deal in the best possible way. And, to sum all this up, Marty was a great, great living example of how to do it. And I think that's why so many people are just dropping everything to make sure they're in Connecticut in September to be part of this.
Yeah.
There is a domain name for people to look at who are listening to this and may want to be part of this. It is titansofdirectresponse.com. And there you'll see all the speakers and an explanation of the agenda, where it is, when it is, and all those other details. Brian Kirst, thank you so much. The time spent remembering Marty is time well spent.
It really is. Thank you. And I'll be doing a deep dive into a lot of these things. In fact, that's the opening session at Titans, where I'll spend a good hour and 15 minutes just deep dive into Marty Edelstein, who he was, what he represented. It's going to be I hope I don't cry too much while I'm doing it, but I think I'll be good.
Well, and then on a practical point, what we can learn from him and all the things that we should be doing that he set the example for that are not only the right way, not only practical and effective, but it's just the right way and a satisfying way to be. So great. Hey, this is coming up really soon. I'm excited, and I will see you in Connecticut.
Yes, I really look forward to it. Thank you so much for the interview and for being a Titan.
Thanks for claiming that I am. I'll take it. All right. I'll talk to you later.
Great.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.